in for Media News. Today, I'm delighted to be talking to writer and journalist Matt Broomfield. Matt was one of the founders of the Rojava Information Centre, which, as its name suggests, is a Rojava-based news agency. He's also a poet, with a book of poems coming out in July, inspired by his time in Rojava, which we shall share the details for at the end of the broadcast. So Matt is intimately involved in a subject that is very close to my heart and to all of us who work for or engage with Media News: how to raise wider awareness of the Kurdish question. Matt, welcome, and thank you for accepting my invitation for this interview.
My pleasure.
So perhaps I could begin by asking you to describe briefly how you yourself became aware of what was happening in Rojava and how that eventually took you out there.
Well, as you mentioned, I had been a journalist for a number of years, a professional freelance journalist in the West. But I'd also been involved in a number of social and political causes, so particularly around homelessness here in the UK and around the refugee crisis that was happening a few years ago and is still continuing indeed in Europe. And so on the one hand, through that work with refugees, I came into contact with the kind of the Kurdish people and people involved in the Kurdish political cause. But more generally, I also started, I guess, thinking a lot about the relationship between my kind of work as a journalist and how I was trying to work with organizations that were trying to directly aid people, that were trying to tackle social issues, were trying to lobby, were trying to campaign, and how to kind of fit those together. Like many people, when I got to learn about what was happening in Rojava in north and east Syria, about, everyone will be aware who's listening to this, I guess, the revolution that started there about 10 years ago, I found the idea very exciting. It gave me a lot of hope. I was very interested in it, but I'm a journalist, I'm a bit cynical, and I like to see things for myself. And so I decided to go out there to see what was happening, to learn from it in the context of the, I guess, social work, social movements that I was involved in the West, and to lend my support if I could, particularly in the field of media, if there was a need for that. And so, a few years ago, I travelled out to northern Syria and ended up loving it and staying there for several years.
And can you tell us the rationale behind the Rojava Information Centre specifically and how it was set up and when? Yeah, some dates would be
absolutely
good.
Absolutely, yeah. So the Rojava Information Centre kind of grew out of some conversations we were having around the time. So the invasion of Afrin had just happened. Turkey had invaded and occupied the region of Afrin, and that had fallen and been lost to Turkey and to the sort of jihadist militias under its control. And Donald Trump, who, as people again will doubtless recall, was the president at the time, announced that he was going to withdraw his troops from the remainder of north and east Syria, thus paving the way for a further Turkish invasion. This would have been towards the end of 2018, December 2018. So I hadn't been in Syria during the Afrin invasion, but some two colleagues of mine had, Joanne and Chloe, with whom I later founded the centre. And obviously that was a very hard time for people kind of experiencing that kind of brutal attack, the deaths of hundreds of civilians, mass displacement. And they were working then in the media. They were kind of trying to raise media awareness around what had happened in Afrin and were not really getting anywhere. So they had this kind of similar project actually during the time of the Afrin war, but they just started it. They were chucking a few tweets out into the ether. And meanwhile, Turkey obviously has this huge PR machine, employs kind of, for example, 4,000 people working on social media campaigning at its headquarters in Ankara, spends billions on lobbying in Washington, in Paris and so on, which is not something that the Kurdish movement obviously can afford to do, is able to do. And so for that reason, for the fact that Turkey has so much money to throw at the media war, for the fact that North East Syria is quite an isolated region, for the fact that the Kurdish movement has been underground for so long and is more used, I think, to working as a kind of activist media and kind of reaching to the Kurdish diaspora and reaching to leftists rather than reaching a mass audience, there was a big, big disparity. And I think, the war was very poorly covered in the West. What happened in Afrin obviously was atrocious. It was ethnic cleansing, but people were like, oh, okay, it's just some more war in Syria, who cares? When it appeared that this new Turkish invasion was going to come, these colleagues of mine came to me. They knew that I was a journalist and said they had the idea to try and do something again along the same lines, and to really try and break out, I guess, of this bubble of, you know, which is important, of informing Kurdish people and informing leftists, and try to create an organization that could reach the mass media, reach the CNNs of this world, reach the BBCs, reach the Fox Newses. Was kind of that was the dream for us, getting on Fox News. And by that, you know, reach not just tens of thousands of leftists, but reach millions of ordinary people in their living rooms, right? And really also try and reach, you know, Washington, reach London, reach Brussels in a meaningful way. To complement the other media work that was going on. So that was the kind of rationale, I think, behind setting up the RIC.
So how do you do it? How do you reach those people who otherwise weren't interested? You know, how do you contact them, and how do you make the content that you're producing of a form that they're going to pick it up and be interested in it and take you seriously?
Absolutely. So there's a couple of points that I would highlight here, maybe 3 points. One just simply about professionalism, one about objectivity, and then one about the sort of more broadly the way we worked. So firstly, and quite simply, then, yeah, a little bit of professionalism, I think, really does go a long way. You know, just using the appropriate language, not calling, the enemy, whatever, the gangs or the terrorists or whatever you might or might not think they are, but saying, okay, you know, here's a war, there's two sides, this is what's happening. So again, in that sense, I guess almost the kind of professional approach feeds into the question of objectivity, but also, you know, just attributing your quotes, you know, not repeating any nonsense that anyone is saying on Twitter without checking it yourself, without going directly to the source, calling people yourself, kind of trying to maintain those journalistic standards. That's a big part of it. Even just having a professional graphic style, something like that, I think helps a lot. Maybe more fundamentally, yeah, as I say, you know, it's no secret, you know, it's the Rojava Information Center. We were there in northern East Syria. We broadly think what's happening in northern East Syria is good, certainly the best thing that's happening in Syria by a very long way. And at that far, I think most foreign correspondents would agree with this, and broadly think that the Turkish invasion is a bad thing, and Turkey's actions in the region are destructive. And again, broadly, 90% of foreign correspondents, I think, would agree with this. We're kind of in a fortunate position, you know, it wouldn't be necessary really to, you don't need to make up propaganda about what's happening, because what's happening is terrible on the one side, and all you have to do is bring that to light. But just having that in mind, no, and, you know, sort of having the confidence, I suppose, to say, you know, yes, this thing has happened on the Turkish side, such and such a violation has also happened on the Kurdish side. Let's say there's a report from Amnesty or from the Human Rights Watch, and normally they will detail violations by all sides, most of them by the Syrian regime, by the Turkish side, then also by al-Nusra, and there will always be something in there also, of course, about something that the autonomous administration has done. So I mentioned that as well, you know, there's no need to hide and kind of act like the one side is perfect, the other side is terrible, but just a little bit goes a long way, no? Particularly in the kind of current media environment, particularly around something like Syria, where there's so much partisan propaganda, but just to be able to say, yes, you know, there are things that can be improved on both sides, and just have like that honest conversation with people, whether that's in something you publish or even just, you know, in a one-to-one kind of conversation over a beer with a journalist in Camislo. People appreciate that now, and they appreciate, you being honest with them, and they know, and when the people know that you're not shitting them, and therefore they know that they can quote you in their articles, and they're not going to be made to look ridiculous or a fool, but it's fine because you're a professional organization doing a professional job. It makes their life easier. No, it's about making life easier for journalists, I think. And that kind of leads me to the third point that for me was, yeah, kind of a really important point, not just sort of strategically, but also almost, yeah, philosophically or ideologically. And that was the importance of kind of connecting journalists with people on the ground. So what we didn't want to do, you know, was just make another kind of news source that was repeating the same news that's being published by the same kind of network of Kurdish news organizations, but to do something a bit different and to kind of enable work directly with journalists and connect them to people on the ground, help them to do their stories. So obviously what you then lose to some extent is editorial control. You can't say, for us, it's really important, we're going to focus on, you know, this issue. You kind of have to go with, okay, all these journalists are coming, all they're interested in right now is the war against ISIS. Fine. We're going to work within that parameter. So that was kind of how that kind of happened to be the situation when we started. It was towards the end of the towards the end of the ISIS war, the kind of final eradication of ISIS as a territorial entity in Syria. So at that time, there was this massive media interest in the region. What we could do is write to all the journalists and say, hi, we're here. If you need contacts, if you have want us to make interviews for you, if you want us to record interviews and send them to you so you can check them, you want to speak directly with the people, whatever, just let us know and we'll kind of make your life easier. But, you know, just almost as like, yeah, an information center, no, as a hub for these journalists. And they gradually would see, okay, I can go there. You know, the Associated Press went there, they got numbers from them, the numbers were accurate, they published it, fine. I will speak to some refugee that they found. I've got the phone number, I can call them myself. I kind of am building up like bit by bit like this, I think, was kind of a key part of how we worked. Obviously, you know, for us, when there was, you know, the 40th foreign correspondent in a row who was like, oh, I'm from Belgium, I would like to speak to a Belgian ISIS member. I'm from Switzerland, I'd like to speak to a Swiss ISIS member. Is what it is. It's fine. That's their job. We'll help them with that. Sure. And then on the one hand, we would always try to, you know, in those circumstances, for example, say, hey, well, why don't you speak to the YPJ as well? Why don't you speak to women's organizers in Raqqa trying to rebuild society after ISIS as well? Why don't you speak to Yazidis enjoying newfound freedoms after the fall of ISIS as well, and try and broaden the conversation? That was certainly part of it. But then also more, more broadly, it's just that, you know, you're in contact with those people, you know, and yeah, they're kind of chatting to you. Hey, have you heard about this? Is this true? Did this happen? This kind of fact checking thing as well. No, it goes back again to what I was saying a moment ago. It really helps as a way of building trust. Now people come to us and say, hey, the autonomous administration said this. Is it true or not? And, you know, we could normally check that and say, you know, yeah, look, 90% of the time, yeah, it's true. 10% of the time, maybe this is, that's kind of where this has come from, you know, this is, I kind of give whatever, contextualize it, whatever it might be, but just be honest in those conversations, the upshot of all of which being, and I guess kind of for us, like a big, not the only aim of our work, but certainly the key founding aim, was that when that war did start, as people will remember, in October 2019, the invasion of Sarakhania and Talabiyad, we were kind of in a position where we were in contact with, you know, hundreds of journalists on the first day were coming to us and saying, what's happening? Can I get a contact for someone in the city? Can you get me in contact with a doctor at the hospital? Can you get me some footage so we can use it on the news? Can one of you appear on Sky News tonight to discuss the situation, and so on and so on? So that, I guess, was kind of the broad strategy. The kind of, I guess the other thing I would mention is that's the kind of side of it in terms of working with foreign press. We do also do our own publications, our own research, which is something that developed a little bit further on when we were kind of had the platform to do that. We kind of built up a platform by working with other press, and we kind of saw, okay, there's things that are really getting misrepresented in the press, things that are being misunderstood, you know, whether it's about how are ISIS being treated in the rehabilitation and detention centres in North and East Syria, whether it's about this whole political system, what is it? How does it work? You know, what is the AANES? What is the SDC? What is this whole alphabet soup? Kind of taking the opportunity to develop, produce our own content as well. But yeah, that is the kind of broad strategy that we took, I would say.
That's great. That gives a very good idea of, yeah, what your role is, that it's, you know, you're not just producing stuff, you're facilitating other people. And I think that's really important to for people to understand.
Yeah. But I was, and then it would kind of, and it would depend a bit, no? So if we would kind of, if this person just wanted to report about ISIS, we'd be like, okay, here's the phone number, kind of do it yourself. This is how it works. If someone came to us and they were like, hi, you know, I'm from this kind of small newspaper in Denmark, and I'd love to do a report about the cooperatives in North and East Syria, how do they work? We'd be like, okay, cool, that's interesting. You know, we'll take a day, then we'll do that with you, you know, cheap or for free, depending on their situation. And yeah, like, you know, different relationships with different kinds of media, no, but it's all, you know, it's worth talking to anyone. And as I say, this was a great kind of success, was my colleague Robin was on Fox News every night for a week. We were like, we've really got out of this left-wing bubble now. We're in uncharted territory.
Yeah. So two questions sort of following from that, really. One is that, do you find that you're having to sort of hold yourself back, self-censoring, for talking about the more radical parts of what they're, of the revolution, really, so that you don't put off the Fox Newses of this world, or even the liberals of this world, actually. But also, what impact do you think you can make by talking to the listeners of Fox News, or the listeners of CNN or the BBC?
On the first point, something I always say is that kind of the great thing about what's happening in northern Syria is it manages to piss everyone off. It pisses off the communists, the anarchists, the conservatives, and the liberals in some way. But it's also got something that appeals to all of them, to all kinds of people. No, you kind of here in the UK, for example, the parliamentary support we do get is kind of half from the conservatives, half from Labour, for kind of various reasons. And so, yeah, I think there is kind of no need to, you know, I'd never feel that I was self-centering myself if, for example, okay, I know I'm speaking to a conservative publication, I'm talking about northern Syria, I'll speak about human rights, speak about, you know, what's happening for women, how life has changed for women, how life has changed for minorities, about the war against ISIS. You know, these are all things that I think are great, you know, they're brilliant, and they're things that kind of have attracted so much support for this movement. If you're speaking with someone who might have a kind of deeper political analysis, more of a left-wing political analysis, then you have the opportunity maybe to have a different conversation, a deeper conversation, maybe at some things that also I find personally interesting. How does the economy work? How does the kind of democratic reorganizing in society work? These are all kind of useful conversations to be having, and that I think, you know, feeds into the second point that, as I said, it's not that speaking to our support, people who support the region, speaking to the Kurdish diaspora, speaking to leftists isn't important. It's immensely important. And that's the kind of base that, you know, kind of enabled the revolution to grow and to get a lot of the kind of early support it did in the West. But you need both. And that was why we set up RSC, was because kind of the one was happening much more than the other. And of course, this kind of mainstream support is vastly important. I mean, that's what has allowed the region to survive. That's what kind of, in large part, that's what precipitated, to be precise, the kind of resistance against ISIS, draw the attention in, and the fact that that resistance against ISIS was magnified worldwide. It was something that went beyond the kind of the left wing or the Kurdish diaspora, and it reached, you know, ordinary people. And that's what everyone knows now. And that's been this huge sea change for the Kurdish movement in the past 10 years. Now that now everyone knows more or less, or a lot of people know, like, who is a Kurd, whereas before people had any idea. Obviously, that only goes so far. And does that translate to material support? Not always. Do people have short memories? Yes. Do you get a lot of thoughts and prayers and not much material support? Yes, of course. But it's really important to be in these spaces and having these conversations, and especially because Turkey, as I say, is so good at it. In the article that I just wrote, I kind of quote as an example this report from the AFP, I think it is, about the Turkish invasion, where, you know, and the report is kind of in theory is saying that this is a bad thing, it's against international humanitarian law, but even then, it's, you know, the Turkish prime minister said this, the Turkish general said this, pro-Turkish analyst said this, and Turkey's in there, Turkey's doing it, Turkey is present in these spaces having these conversations, and we have every right to be as well. And it's kind of, yeah, this is also something that I care quite a lot about, is this kind of legitimization of the movement. No, and this is kind of broader than just the RIC, but, you know, the fact that there is no place at the official negotiations over Syria for a single representative from North and East Syria, which is a third of the country. It's absurd. No, the way that people will dismiss the region and then criticize on those terms. You know, people will refuse to engage with the kind of political leadership, will only be interested in the SDF and the YPG, and then will come along and be like, oh, well, you're just, a military, paramilitary group. You know, you're not a real kind of political entity. But if we're not a real political entity, it's because international actors refuse to accept the region as a real political entity. And so to kind of shift the conversation on that, and as I say, you know, it's not so much actually about, you know, the RAC team members being on TV, but it's about having the head of the SDC, it's about having representatives of the women's movement, whoever it might be, having their voices in these spaces. That is something which is kind of slowly developing. Like, the SDC is doing really good work on the international stage, and in terms of the media, I think it's, yeah, really important just to create that kind of balance.
So you clearly aren't afraid to be critical of the autonomous administration. What sort of response do you get from them when you're critical of them?
Well, as I say, I think we're in the fortunate position where any honest report about the region will kind of give the context, which is really important, of the enormous pressures that the administration is under. The military pressure, obviously, but also the economic pressure, the lack of political recognition that I was just talking about, the lack of UN aid, since that was closed. And so anyway, I could go on, but you get the point, right, that there are like valid criticisms to be made of the administration, of the way they're dealing with some situations. Situation whole camp is a very complicated situation to deal with, and I'm extraordinarily glad it's not my responsibility. But yeah, like of course there are people, there are criticisms to be made about that. The situation in the kind of majority Arab regions liberated from ISIS, again, it's immensely hard. You know, many ISIS supporters, many regime supporters, very conservative regions, and the administration's got a very tough job there. But that being said, that's why it's kind of so important to foster this kind of spirit of openness and dialogue. Of course, it's, I think, a little bit different for an organisation which is Western-facing and, you know, engaging in, dialogue with kind of Western actors, but it's something we would really try to encourage. It's also, yeah, something that for me was always really important was the administration kind of often would have this approach. If there's a critical article, they wouldn't give any response. They'd be like, kind of, no comments. And what we would always say is, look, Turkey is, if you write a critical article about Turkey, they will have some very well-paid PR guy will come out and say, ah, well, no, you see, actually, you've misunderstood. We're not a fascist state at all. It was all just a big misunderstanding. We love the West or whatever. And, you know, it's just basic media strategy, right? You, even if you don't like the article, you come out, you say something, you give your side of the argument, try and encourage that. The other thing, the other thing I'd say on this for me is that seeing those kind of tensions and difficulties, to some extent, was actually one of the really like interesting and inspiring things about being there. Of course, it would be, so there might be, you know, kind of criticisms about humanitarian conditions or something. Might be criticisms about actions of the SDF. That's kind of one thing. And then just the appropriate thing there is to deal with it, have an investigation, move on. That's kind of one side. But for me, what was really interesting, especially in my final year in Syria, was going to these regions where things were so difficult, going to Raqqa, for example, where there was this kind of unrest, and then being there present in the public consultations where the administration itself was opening itself up to criticism. No? And we then kind of produced, yeah, some of my favourite reports I did actually was just listening to all the stuff people had to say, you know, like local women, local youth activists, but also these sheikhs who were working with ISIS like 5 years ago, sitting in a room with this kind of Kurdish politician who, like, from, you know, not so long ago, they would have had thrown in jail or killed, all kind of trying to talk together. Now, you know, that is really exciting and it's really positive. And it was really, I was really, felt really lucky to be able to be present in those conversations and to be able to relay that through reports that we did for the RIC to the outside world. No, that's kind of what I would say about that.
Continuing on a slightly similar point, I suppose we're living in a time when restrictions on media outlets are becoming normalised, and often, as for example with the UK ban on Russia Today, it's done in the name of freedom. The Autonomous Administration of Northern East Syria has also banned some journalists and media organisations. So I wondered if you could just say, explain what's happened and the justifications that were given for that.
Yeah, in terms of media press freedom in Northern East Syria, obviously it's an issue that's very, very close to my heart, having worked with the press there for quite a long time. Really, I think the first thing one does have to emphasise is how infinitely better the situation is for journalists in Northern East Syria compared to certainly anywhere else in Syria. Certainly much better than Turkey, the world's number one, or has been the world's number one jailer of journalists in recent years. Certainly much better than Iraq, much better than Iraqi Kurdistan. Okay, but you know, that's not the kind of get out of jail free. On the converse, you know, we should be holding ourselves to the kind of highest possible standards of openness. Maybe I should actually just kind of paint a quick picture for kind of listeners of what, you know, what is and what isn't allowed in the press in Syria. What's the situation? So foreign press can pretty much all operate in Northern East Syria, which is also kind of ironically comes around and bites the administration in the behind quite a bit, because press can't go anywhere else in Syria. So they all come to Northern East Syria. And then, of course, you know, they will want to write critical stories. Foreign press are pretty much all allowed to do that, with the exception, obviously, of the Turkish state press and the Qatari state press that work with Turkey. But otherwise, they're pretty much all free to do that, which is good. ask the journalists, and they will complain and say that the SDF, you know, makes life difficult for them, and they can't go to a whole camp whenever they want. Six of one, half a dozen of the other. Journalists are annoying. The press the press bureaucracy can be annoying. That's kind of that. Then in terms of the, there's kind of press which is directly controlled by the administration. There's then pro-Kurdish press, which is independent, but yeah, kind of broadly supportive of the administration on kind of major issues. Then in terms of opposition media, so kind of the main opposition media, and I think what you're mentioning here is they're controlled by the Bazar, the kind of Bazani-controlled media, so Rudaw and K24, they're controlled by Kurdistan Democratic Party, which, in case people don't know, is the dominant party in neighbouring Iraqi Kurdistan, which has a kind of very different political perspective, is much closer to America, is more kind of crony capitalism, I think would be the best way to describe it, and is quite hostile to North and East Syria, and is hostile also to the PKK. They have their own media organs as well, Rudaw and K24, who generally kind of say in the beginning we're not allowed, then they were allowed, and then sometimes they're banned, sometimes they come back. I think Rudaw, kind of one of their journalists, again got banned at the start of this year. And yeah, that generally is happening in the context of, so no, so the media of North East Syria is never allowed to operate at all in the KRG, so in Iraqi Kurdistan. Mostly they do kind of, possibly not that happily, but they do allow the Kurdish opposition media to report. But when things are tense, as they are now, it's one of the ways they will apply pressure is by banning those journalists, which, yeah, I think is not great, obviously. And that's, so those opposition media channels are the main kind of voices of taking a different angle and being critical angle against the administration that are kind of active and on TV and broadcasting in the region. So yeah, for me, it's good to have them there. For most of the past few years, they have been there, but not always. Then there's the kind of the other, I mean, the other things you will get is it's kind of pro-regime media, so you have pro-regime kind of radio and newspapers and that kind of thing, particularly again in the Arab regions that are much more pro-regime. And then, yeah, there are various kind of websites as well. Again, more from the, so on the Arab side, because it's quite kind of ethnic, you know, the Kurdish media and the Arab media. So there's, yeah, kind of Islamist through radical Islamist kind of websites, Facebook pages that would be critical of the regime, of the administration for not being Islamic enough. And then some of them also running to, yeah, for example, there's stuff like Deir-Ezor 24, which is a great resource, kind of working with reporters in that region, which is the most kind of troubled region of North and East Syria, which is, yeah, again, it kind of, I guess, takes the angle that while the administration is better than ISIS and better than the regime, they don't like everything they're doing, and they don't like the kind of way that they're trying to deal with the ISIS insurgency in the area that exists. Kind of, I guess, not registered, but quasi-legally. And again, I think that's something really good. That's someone that, you know, as the RIC, we would always work with being in contact with. Yeah, that's kind of the picture. So there is kind of room for opposition media in a way that there's not anywhere else in the region, but more needs to be done. There is a media union, Free Media Union, who have kind of intervened successfully before when, yeah, there's been this kind of tit-for-tat banning of journalists or whatever it might be. And generally then, yeah, I think things are going in the right direction, but the kind of pressure does need to be kept on to make sure that keeps happening, yeah.
I mean, it's another example, I suppose, of when one says it's a work in progress, that, you know, it's not doing all the things that it says on the tin yet.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and it's, well, you know, and I don't want, you know, it's, you know, I don't like to answer these questions and be like, well, actually, it's much worse everywhere else in Syria, because, you know, obviously, and that's, you know, the administration is putting itself forward as the alternative, therefore, has to be held itself to higher standards. And as I say, what is good, I like to see, it's great to see, and that that movement is very capable of doing, is holding itself to account. It kind of, yeah, to take the example again of these Arab regions, you have the situation where the movement says we want to devolve decision-making power. We want kind of devolved democracy, like local people can decide how to run their own affairs. You know, we're against centralism. This is kind of, that's kind of fundamental on the one hand. Then you have the principle of kind of women's autonomy, women's liberation. Then you go to a region like Deir ez-Zor, where what the local people want mostly is that women shouldn't, you know, should remain at home, have their heads covered, get married young, raise children. So, you know, there's just, you, something's got to give, right? And then that's the, to kind of engage with that. And often it's kind of, you know, I've, again, found myself being like, I'll probably be like, well, forget about it. Like, I'm in charge and, you know, you're, but they kind of, they've made concessions on issues like this. And that's, you know, it's really tough, you know, for the women's movement to like listen to this kind of very conservative understanding and from women themselves now. And that's one example. But yeah, like when, you know, when the movement is able to engage in these kind of serious and critical conversations, I think it's something that really gives me a lot of hope.
I just want to finish with on a more personal note, I suppose, and a major reason why spreading news about the Kurds is so hard, of course, is that people in authority in Europe and in the US often don't want to hear it, and they don't want to give breathing space to a non-capitalist ideology that's demonstrating the possibility of a fairer, different sort of society. And they don't want to upset the NATO ally, Turkey. And sometimes for them, just ignoring what's happening in Rojava isn't enough. And they take additional steps to crush the links that are being made to discourage connections with Rojava. So last year, you were arrested while on holiday in Greece. You were kept for 2 months in a refugee detention center, and then given a 10-year ban on traveling in the Schengen area. So clearly it's not put you off your own involvement with the Kurds, but can you...
They've banned me now, haven't they?
And tell us a little more about what's happening, what you think they're trying to do, or what the implications of this is. And we've reached half an hour, so if you can sort of pull everything together at the same time, that would be brilliant.
Yeah, absolutely. You've kind of summed up what happened. There's more details about the ins and outs of it online as well, if people are interested. I think, yeah, I mean, with what happened to me, as I was saying, I would just really put this in the context of, as I said, Turkey is one of the number one jailers of journalists in the world, that many journalists have been killed in the line of duty in northern Syria, that Turkey kind of aggressively and with all means at its disposal tries to stamp out the truth of what's happening in Kurdistan. And sadly, a lot of international actors are complicit in that, and will work with Turkey, of course, not just in the field of media, but to aggressively pursue any form of solidarity with, support for, even physically traveling to the region of Kurdistan. It really doesn't take that much for Turkey to really want to go after you. I think the crucial point about what happened to me is, I'm kind of, it's an inconvenience, but you know, I'm perfectly fine now back in England. But that this could happen, you know, I'm banned without any recourse to any appeal, without having known that this had happened, without having done, I think, anything that any court in Europe would think of as illegal in the slightest, for 10 years, but at Turkey's behest, that's what's happened here. And of course, you see the kind of complicity of state actors in what's happening now. It's this kind of interesting situation, isn't it, with the Kurdish cause and with what's happening in northern East Syria with the Kurdish political movement, that there is this kind of general goodwill towards it. And people generally like the Kurds, and people generally say, you know, sort of Western democratically minded, liberally minded people don't really like Erdogan. They don't like the Islamification of Turkish society. If they knew really what was happening and how serious the situation was, they might be a bit more shocked, I think. But when the chips are down, state actors will stand together. That is, of course, it still remains important for us to attempt to work in this terrain, whether that's in the field of media, whether that's through kind of political engagement diplomatically, whether that's through the kind of legal cases that we're engaging in, that the movement is engaging with now on the kind of European level. These are all important. Of course, we can never forget that, you know, what's happening, as I said, in northern East Syria, although it might have won some support, is making a lot of people angry because it dares to say something different. It dares to do something different. It dares to stand for something different in a region where we're told only bad things can come out of it, and therefore it's in a lot of people's interests to put down what's happening there. And that's why I guess we can finish on that point now, that it's really important that we are able to have these conversations, to be public and vocal, as you said, in our criticisms, also in our support, I think, for what's happening in the region, and to kind of keep working to that end.
Thanks very much, Matt. And obviously we're trying in all different ways to let people know what's happening, to get people involved, to try and build up the mass movement that's needed to support what's happening. And I mean, you're not just doing it through journalism, you're doing it through other writing as well. So I wondered if you'd just like to just finish by letting people know about your book.
Oh yeah, So I'm also a poet. I kind of, published poet here in the UK. My first kind of full-length book of poetry is coming out this summer. You can order it now. If you search for Matt Broomfield's Brave Little Sternums, Poems from Rojava, you can order it from the publishers. It will also be in all good bookshops. And I guess kind of in a bleak way. Explore some of the issues we've talked about today. What it's like, I guess, to be in the revolution. Some of the things that you might not be able to say when you're on Fox News. What is it like? What are the difficulties? What are the challenges? What are the causes for despair? And what are the causes for hope?
Thank you. Thanks very much, Matt, for being with us today.
My pleasure.